Today is Monday, July 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Iran says it has arrested 17 Iranian nationals allegedly recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency to spy on the country's nuclear and military sites. Also, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam said that all of Hong Kong and its people will suffer if violence continues.
Violence is not a solution to any problem.
And India's space agency successfully launched an unmanned spacecraft to the far side of the moon. Those stories and more are all ahead on today's International Edition. Iran said it has arrested 17 Iranian nationals allegedly recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency. VOA National Security correspondent Jeff Selden spoke with me earlier and had this update.
Well, Iran has come out both with an unnamed intelligence minister or counterintelligence official giving a briefing. They've also shared some information with photos showing alleged CIA handlers with state media. And they've put all this out. But these types of claims are not new. And back, they say that many of these arrests have taken place over the past 12 months. Back in April, there were allegations that they made that they had made a bunch of arrests and broken up a huge U.S. spy ring. In June, there were more allegations. At that point, a U.S. official told VOA that there wasn't anything behind those claims. And then today we have these latest set of claims, including the allegations that some of these 17 have been sentenced to death. You have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo telling Fox News that to take these allegations with a grain of salt. And then you have the president, President Donald Trump himself, taking to Twitter to say and saying that there's no truth to any of this. So these are claims that are made routinely by Iran. There are claims that are routinely disputed by the U.S.
What might we see moving forward with this type of situation?
Well, this plays into the bigger conflict in the larger picture with Iran, where tensions have steadily been ratcheting higher and higher. Remember, back in June, Iran shot down a U.S. drone, which it said had violated its airspace. The U.S. denied that it was in Iranian airspace. The acting Secretary of Defense at the time, Mike Esper, said clearly it was international airspace. And then just about a week ago, the Marines above a U.S. amphibious ship that was transiting through the Strait of Hormuz in international waters said that they had downed an Iranian drone. So there's a lot of tension. Again, obviously, there's intelligence operations that are ongoing, both in the cyber realm, where U.S. officials have been increasingly wary of Iran's propaganda activities, misinformation activities, as well as their targeting of major corporations, oil and gas companies that have interests in the Middle East. But also, look, the U.S. has always had an interest in Iran's nuclear activities. And one of the big concerns from the administration is that despite the restrictions that were put in place by the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, as it's sometimes called, the Trump administration has alleged Iran was continuing to work on its operations. In the past, U.S. intelligence has gained some insight. Israeli intelligence operations have gained some insight into Iranian operations. So there's going to be a continued war of intelligence, in essence, between the U.S., the West, and Iran. But how it plays out is becoming more and more worrisome to officials who say, look, the degree of direct confrontation now, especially in the Strait of Hormuz, is growing. And that means that we've heard from top military officials in the U.S., that means there's a risk of misunderstanding, miscalculation, that could lead to a bigger, wider conflict.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
So, British Prime Minister Theresa May held an emergency security session Monday to discuss how to respond to Iran's seizure of a British flag tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt plans to brief Parliament on the seizure Friday of the Stena Impero tanker and its crew of 23. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam said that all of Hong Kong and its people will suffer if violence continues to disrupt the special administrative region. For more, I spoke with Hong Kong-based journalist Justin Solomon.
Well, So the march on Sunday was peaceful at first. It followed a route that the police had okayed and agreed to. But the police were very adamant that the march had to stop at a certain location, and the marchers weren't going to have that. So they continued on further into the city center of Hong Kong, all the way to the China liaison office, where things took a more violent turn. And that's when police had to use tear gas to disperse those protesters. And that's something that we've seen often over the last 7 weeks here in Hong Kong, where these peaceful protests and marches turn violent at the end.
I've also seen some reports that the police may have fired rubber bullets into the protesters. Has that been discussed at all?
So it has been discussed on some social media chat boards and messaging groups that I've been following, and local media has reported that as well, although it isn't as prominent as was reported back on June 12th, where when things really started kicking off here in Hong Kong and rubber bullets were used, beanbag shots were fired, and more tear gas.
If we take a look specifically at the violence on Sunday's protests, there's been some allegations and some suggestions that the triads were involved. What can you tell us about that?
So there are two separate incidents that we're talking about on Sunday. The first, of course, is the march on Sunday that went into Hong Kong city center. The second is a violent attack about 30 minutes outside of Hong Kong Central at a MTR station, a public transit station called Yuen Long. There, a group of men wearing white T-shirts violently attacked commuters. Many of those commuters were wearing black T-shirts. Those most likely had just returned from the march in central Hong Kong. There are reports on social media and messaging groups saying that those attackers in white T-shirts are part of the crime group known as the Triad. And some of those messaging groups have even accused the Hong Kong police of allowing those violent attacks, which injured 45 people, to actually unfold.
So how did the police respond to those attacks?
Well, that has actually become quite a controversy here in Hong Kong, and it's kind of twofold. The first is, did the police respond to those attacks in a timely manner? The answer to many is no, they didn't. They have a reason for that. They say they were concentrating their efforts on the protests that were going on in central Hong Kong. And the second aspect is, were the police somehow involved in these attacks by intentionally delaying their response to them? Many people in the MTR station called 999, which is the Hong Kong equivalent of 911, and couldn't get through. Today at a press conference, Hong Kong's leader Carrie Lam and the chief of police reacted to those claims. Carrie Lam saying that government officials are not related in any way to the Triad and the attacks. She did acknowledge, though, that the government may not have done a good job in its response. Meanwhile, chief of police Stephen Lowe also said he's asking for the public to trust the police force, and that's something that is becoming increasingly harder and harder for residents here in Hong Kong.
And that was Hong Kong reporter Justin Solomon.
5, 4, 3.
India's space agency successfully launched an unmanned spacecraft to the far side of the moon Monday, a week after aborting the mission due to a technical problem. Scientists at the Mission Control Center burst into applause as the rocket lifted off in clear weather, as scheduled, at 9:13 Universal Time on Monday. K. Sivan, chairman of Indian Space Research Organization and the secretary of Indian Department of Space, said that it was an historical day for space and science and technology in India.
I'm extremely happy to announce that GSLV Mark III vehicle successfully injected Chandrayaan 2 in the defined orbit. In fact, the orbit is 6,000 kilometers more than what our internet is better.
India plans to send its first manned space flight by 2022. Here are some other headlines from around the world. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has said his meeting with President Donald Trump that he is stressing the need for a political resolution to the protracted war in Afghanistan. Benjamin Netanyahu has become Israel's longest-serving prime minister, surpassing the country's founding leader, David Ben-Gurion. Medical sources tell VOA Somali Service that at least 17 people were killed and 28 others were injured in a car bombing in Mogadishu. You will find expanded coverage of these stories and more all at the voanews.com website and with our VOA mobile application. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
As astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were taking their first steps on the moon on July 20th, 1969, there were people who claimed that the moon landing was faked and its television coverage was nothing more than an elaborate motion picture produced in Hollywood. 50 years later, the conspiracy theory still attracts attention. Trevor Ireland, a space rock expert at the Australian National University and one of the scientists to analyze moon rock and soil samples, says taking a good look at the materials collected by the astronauts is all that it takes to debunk the conspiracy theories. He says the lunar soil was nothing that had been seen before on Earth, and the composition of the rocks are unique to the moon. He suggests any attempt to make moon rocks in a laboratory would be a failure and would cost more money than it would take NASA to get to the moon and back. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A leading Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives says Special Counsel Robert Mueller will give very substantial evidence this week that will make the case for impeaching President Donald Trump. To get a preview of Mueller's upcoming testimony, I earlier spoke with VOA Justice Department correspondent Masood Farvar.
Well, the number one thing to keep in mind about this hearing is that we are not going to learn anything about the investigation that we don't already know. That is because the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has made it very clear that he's going to stick to his report, the final report.
Then why have the hearings at all?
Well, he had no choice but to appear before the two committees. He was subpoenaed, as you know, a few weeks ago by the Democrats who control the House. There are opportunities for both the Democrats and the Republicans on both committees before which he appears. The number one goal for the Democrats is to simply get, as the chairman of the Intel Committee, Schiff, said, simply get the special counsel to bring what is a dry legal report to life, as he put it, whatever that means. Now, the Democrats are hoping that simply getting the special counsel to read portions of the report that discuss potential instances of obstruction of justice on the part of the president could be powerful in terms of shaping public opinion. Keep in mind that only 3% of Americans say that they have read the whole report.
What about the Republicans on their side? Since you mentioned that Adam Schiff, the chair of the Intelligence Committee, is trying to bring the report to life and highlight allegations of wrongdoing, what are the Republicans saying?
Well, I think for the Republicans, there are a couple of opportunities here. Number one, they could attack the special counsel and his team's credibility by pointing to their alleged conflicts of interest. But that is seen as a very risky tactic that could potentially backfire on them, given the lack of evidence about their conflicts of interest. There's another line of questioning that they say that they plan to pursue, and that is to focus on the origins of the investigation, how this 22-month investigation came about. They allege that it was started on the basis of bogus evidence in the so-called Steele dossier. So I think the focus is going to be on that. There's also, as you know, during the past year or two, exchanges in text exchanges between two members of the Mueller team criticizing the president came to light, and that have been used by the Republicans and other allies of the president as evidence that this investigation was biased against the president, it was flawed. And the whole origin of the investigation is now under review by the Justice Department. So the Republicans are likely to zero in on that aspect of the investigation.
Masoud Farivar is VOA's justice correspondent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Official police figures in New Zealand show residents have handed over more than 10,000 guns, weapons, parts, and accessories in the first week of a buyback plan prompted by the country's worst peacetime mass shooting. VOA's Luis Ramirez has more.
A gun reform law passed in April banned most semi-automatic firearms, parts that convert firearms into semi-automatics, magazines over a certain capacity, and some shotguns. Owners have until December 20th to hand in their weapons, and the government has set aside over $140 million to compensate them for up to 95% of the original cost. The buyback comes 4 months after a lone gunman with semi-automatic weapons attacked Muslims attending Friday prayers in Christchurch on New Zealand's South Island, killing 51 people. A police spokesman told Reuters that more than 2,000 people have surrendered more than 11,000 firearms, parts, and accessories, and in return, authorities have paid them slightly more than $4 million since the buyback began last Saturday. Brenton Tarrant is accused of the March 15th killings. He is due to stand trial in May and has pleaded not guilty to 92 charges over the attacks, including New Zealand's first terrorism charge. With a population of just under 5 million and an estimated total of 1.5 million firearms, New Zealand ranks 17th in the world in terms of civilian firearm ownership, according to a small arms survey. Luis Ramirez, VOA News.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the African Continental Free Trade Area is now a reality that, if successful, will create a $3.4 trillion economic bloc. A closer look at Africa's free trade agreement on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, thank you for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. This month, Border Crossings is giving away a really cool Voice of America t-shirt.
Hooray!
If you want to win one of these awesome shirts, all you have to do is make a song request for our show.
I see it, I like it, I want it.
Tune into Border Crossings at 1500 Universal Time every weekday in August for your chance to win.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The United Nations says conditions in Syria continue to deteriorate and humanitarian needs for millions of civilians remain acute across the war-torn country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN Special Envoy for Syria, Najat Rushdie's job is to keep tabs on the humanitarian situation in Syria. She says conditions in this country, which has been at war for more than 8 years, are alarming. She's appealing to the international community to protect and support millions of vulnerable civilians who lack the bare essentials for survival. She says an estimated 11.7 million people need humanitarian aid and 5 million are in acute need. She says it has been a particularly grave month for civilians caught up in intensified fighting between government and rebel forces in Idlib in northwestern Syria. Her spokeswoman, Jennifer Fenton, says at least 350 civilians reportedly have been killed and more than 330,000 have been displaced. She says some 3 million people are at particular risk. She says they are trapped in the battle zone and are at the mercy of the warring parties as there is no place where they can flee.
Civilian infrastructure continues to be damaged and destroyed. Protection of civilians remains our foremost concern. Far too many civilians are dying. Fighting terrorism does not absolve any party of its obligations under international humanitarian law. and we continue to call on parties to uphold their agreements and to stabilize the situation.
Fenton says the situation remains unsustainable for some 70,000 people living in the squalid, overcrowded Al-Hol camp in northeastern Syria. These people fled to Al-Hol after the Syrian government seized control of Deir ez-Zor, the radical Islamic State group's last stronghold. The vast majority of the camp population is comprised of Syrian and Iraqi women and children. This population includes more than 11,000 family members of suspected IS foreign fighters from dozens of countries. These nations are reluctant to bring back their nationals, fearing prosecutions of IS fighters will be difficult and will alienate their citizens. UNICEF and other agencies are urging nations to repatriate an estimated 29,000 children of foreign IS fighters, noting they are blameless and are victims of this brutal war. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports a number of children have been repatriated to their countries of origin in past weeks, but it adds thousands of others remain in Al-Hol facing an uncertain future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As drought hit towns across New South Wales and Queensland edge closer to completely running out of water, federal and state governments in Australia are trying to come up with ways to guarantee supplies into the future. But on the other side of the continent, the city of Perth is leagues ahead in its water efficiency following a long-time decline in rainfall. Phil Mercer reports part of its survival plan relies on recycled water from toilets, a move that many consumers elsewhere find unpalatable.
Since 2017, residents in the Western Australian city of Perth have been drinking water recycled from sewage. It's filtered using a process called reverse osmosis, which is similar to forcing water through a giant sponge. It's then disinfected with ultraviolet light at a treatment plant, pumped into natural aquifers and extracted. Perth is a city of 2 million people, and Claire Lugar from Western Australia's Water Corporation says it's had to get used to climatic changes.
We know from the mid-70s onwards, Perth's rainfall has been declining by about 20%, and that's had a huge impact on our water sources that are dependent on the climate.
Lugar says convincing residents of the benefits of drinking recycled sewage did take time.
So it's only a small percentage of the water that comes into the plant is actually from our toilets. But getting over that perception, that kind of image that you might be drinking the water that you're flushing down the toilet, that was probably one of our big challenges initially.
Two desalination plants supply about half of Perth's water. Aquifers are also crucial, but recycling produces only 2% of the total. But that figure is soon expected to rise. Ian Wright, an expert in environmental science at Western Sydney University, believes other parts of Australia should embrace recycling.
In Sydney, that's probably 150 litres per day per person of wastewater that's completely wasted. And yes, we have the availability of desalination on the coast, but Canberra doesn't have desalination. And then the poor drought-stricken towns like Tamworth and Dubbo and Broken Hill, they could really, really use that now.
Australia is the world's driest inhabited continent. Water is precious and in many places scarce. More than 95% of New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, is officially in drought. And the next 3 months are forecast to be drier than average. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has said the nuclear watchdog chief, Yukiya Amano, has died Thursday at the age of 72. The announcement was made today after a request from the family for privacy during the funeral. And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, engineer Joe Gill, and Kate Pound Dawson, our managing editor, thank you so much for joining us. Now for pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile application, you can download the stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I am Steve Miller in Washington. Have a magnificent Monday.